Hi everyone, this is Matt Price, host of Dynasty Game Night. My co-host John Bosch and I created this podcast for one reason, to focus on fun. After all, fun is the reason we all started playing fantasy football in the first place. I love games of all sorts, card games, board games, video games, really any kind of game you can think of. So one day, John and I decided it was time for a podcast where we just play games. You might learn something along the way, but you won't find much hard-hitting analysis here. Check out all the other incredible podcasts DLF has to offer for that sort of thing. On Dynasty Game Night, our primary focus is to entertain. So if you like playing games or watching game shows, this might just be the podcast for you. We'd love for you to give it a listen and play along with the contestants and maybe even win a chance to be on the show.
Hello and welcome back to the Dynasty Crossroads, a member of the DLF family of podcasts. My name is Peter Howard at PA Howdy. I'm your sole host these days, second day sitting here alone at the crossroads, having fun out here, to be honest. It's not a great season for guests, apparently, unless you're every other podcast. I just went on the Dynasty Game Night podcast. If you want to see me get owned by the Zookeeper and John Bosch alike, I don't know, I felt like I hold my own. They didn't. They laughed pretty heavily. But I was also on the Open Bar podcast a few nights ago as well. If you'd like to check that out to see me get owned in a more social setting as well. Lots of being owned out there, which is great. Great to see. A few different reactions to last week's podcast. One kind of divided by 50-50, which I guess is about right. Not everyone's going to like everything you do, so 50-50 is about right. Some enjoying the more off the cuff, just initial unbiased look at what I saw initially with players. Some people thought it was terrible. sounded too unprepared, didn't like my running back lack of enthusiasm at all. It is what it is. I know it's rookie season, and something someone mentioned about last week's podcast, they didn't expect to hear me uncertain, but the truth of it is I'm mostly uncertain. I think that's one of my largest assets. I disbelieve everything, try to argue the opposite, and certainty is just where I go and you have no other choice. Like, this is the time of year I allow myself to be more uncertain than most as well, because we know the least about most of the conversations going on right now. Really, it's time to dig into 2019 or enjoy the playoffs, and instead we're all talking about the thing we know the least about and the least important information about right now. So I know it's rookie season, and I'm working hard to put more content out there. I haven't written an article, and I don't plan to for a few weeks about 2019 or anything else. Like, I'm letting everything simmer. I'm trying to enjoy the playoffs. I actually have more classes starting for my actual job, and I have done nothing on that, by the way, so my students can blame you guys. I best get to that, I guess. But I've actually pushed out my NFL database update for 2019, combined with my market share database for college prospects. Like, that's all out there now. I'm still fine-tuning, as I always am. I want to run some new models and test some things, but mostly all my data's out there, including my Red Zone database and my updated AYARDS, which you can get free from AYARDS.com, but I do a few things with it and try and marry it to my NFL debate. That's all out there. Just go follow my pinned tweet, whatever. And you've got access to it now. But I'm not going to do a lot of talking about rookies tonight. Sorry, I know it's a season, but like, someone's got to slowly roll. And there are some interesting questions. I actually got one from someone who's a Patreon. That's not the only reason I'm answering it tonight or looking at it tonight, but it is a question I had myself, and I started to look at it briefly because I'm a terrible podcast guest. While I was talking on the Open Bar, I just started looking through some things, and some numbers popped, and so I'd like to give my what I noticed about Juju's season, which might not be easily read right off the cuff just from his outright numbers or the fact he missed a bunch of games and only played in 12, and you know, everyone's going to talk about the situation, I guess, but his value is a really interesting point right now. I think it's dropping, and I don't entirely agree with that. I do think my hopes for his value really obviously have not come true. I thought another solid season, even a top 12 season at his age with his hype coming into this year, that could have promoted him to the Dynasty wide receiver one and we would have recruited instant value. That's clearly not going to happen. But the backup plan was always he's really young and we already know he's really good. So that's where we're at. But I want to talk a little bit more in depth about his season, looking at some of his production numbers and the team production numbers as well. Just to sate some rookie curiosity, I guess. Like I said, my database is out there, but one thing I've been looking at running backs, I've just been digging down, looking at historical comps. Like, I have a pre-draft model and a post-draft model, which obviously isn't relative to the 2020 class right now. We don't have combine data or draft capital data. But some things that I'm noticing, if you want a proxy, just a quick glance, which is really what we should be aiming for right now, just a quick glance of who they were in college. Yards per touch in my database proved not great, nothing's great, but a really interesting overview of the past six or seven classes as I was looking at it, and so that's an interesting set just to get yourself a quick glance at who these players are and what they did in college. Two noticeable exceptions were Le'Veon Bell and Arian Foster, just through the draft classes that I looked at. Both came up around 5.5 yards per touch, which isn't great. Like, six or over was noticeably decent, seven or over was good. And the top prospects in every RB class that I looked at were the most interesting for most draft classes of the last six or seven, like I said. Again, not a ranking, but it was an interesting overview. So I'd take a look at that. Edney, I think, came out in the top in this class so far in the yards per touch. And that's the other thing. So far, it's not just I haven't perfected the data or I haven't finished looking. Like, there are rookies that we don't even know we're going to be interested in yet. Despite this class being so long and so long hyped, data bursts aren't out. They're not on the list. There's always a surprise at the combine or a surprise in the draft, all seven. So we probably don't have a full view, not just because the ones I haven't declared, but the ones who are declaring or will declare that we're not yet including in our judgment. So another interesting point to put on the class, like, it might expand. I would say, though, that I am seeing more of the depth that people have been talking about, like Zachary of the Dynasty Dummies podcast. A known number of players in the running back class scored over 12 in my pre-draft model. Now, my pre-draft model, like, I've told you I don't trust my running back models, but I'm trying to put that in more context. If my pre-draft running back model was a person, like, it could come in my house. It could hang out and come for a visit. If it came over too often, I would be, like, really annoyed it was intruding on my time, though, and I wouldn't let it alone with my kids while it was in the house. My post-draft model, you know, I'd leave the room to go get a drink. It's fine. It's safe. And it could probably come over whenever it wanted. For my running back post-draft model, pre-draft model, you know, probably not. If that puts any kind of extra context on what those two do for you, or do for me, that's kind of the way I think of them. You know, it's allowed in. I don't think it's untrustworthy. I think it's fine. I think it's a good person. I just hope it doesn't come around too much, and I wouldn't leave it alone with the kids. That's all I'm saying. And also, for the running back case in the pre-draft model, like, two players scored over 14. It's basically on a scale from 0 to 14. It's basically the scale for over 14 points in my pre-draft model. It's fairly rare. The max any class has ever had is two players, and the 2020 class has equaled that. And so that's a sign that there is some of the ceiling that some people have been talking about. But again, as I posted on Twitter, like, a lot of the players that score well in the pre-draft model, again, where I'd let it in my house, but not alone with my children, like, you know, some of the better prospects outside of, like, Dalvin Cook and outside of Saquon Barkley that score in this range, they're like Justin Jackson and Brian Hill, who I was excited about too, but I'm really hoping, like, the players don't go that direction, drafted behind other backs, low in the draft. That's still a potential, even just looking at my pre-draft model. Alright, enough rookies. Let's talk about some non-rookies for a second, shall we? So Juju Smith-Schuster, you may notice they didn't quite have the season a lot of us were hoping. Where did he finish overall? One of the things I've got open should be able to tell me. So Juju Smith-Schuster finished as a 62nd PPR ranked wide receiver. So that's not points per game. That's just his overall fantasy points were 62nd, according to my new NFL database, for the wide receiver position. He finished 30th in 2007, that great rookie season that he had, and he was 8th last year. As we know, in 2018. So a precipitous drop. He did only play 12 games, not 14 or 16 like he did in the season before. We know he was hampered a little bit, but I'm not really looking to take that excuse. Even with 12 games with the type of player I think Juju Smith-Schuster is, he definitely should have outproduced what he did. Let's just accept that. His production was low even for the season he had, even with Mason Rudolph. I do think the significance... noise here to suggest that Juju didn't play up to what he had played his ability in 2018 or even 2017. Let's not say he didn't play badly. Hopefully, as I get some guests on as the off season winds up, and I can get some more people in here to talk to me, that they can provide more of a tape view or more of an on-field view. But even the numbers, it's pretty clear he didn't play as well. For example, just looking at his air yards data, one of my favorite ways to evaluate players' opportunity. But if we're looking for efficiency, how well a player performed on this opportunity, like I say, it still showed 3 wasn't quite the player we can expect of him. For example, he had a 0.78 racer score, or 78% if you just want a nicer number. 2 years prior to that, he was at basically a 1, so 100% efficiency. Again, that... it's not meant to be a percentage, so 100% sounds impossible, which is, but sometimes converting it to a percentage is just an easier number for people who aren't numbers oriented to get in their heads. I do it for myself quite often. For reference, about 0.7 is about average wide receivers, not average top 12, average top 24, but just players who are getting a significant number of targets and receptions. You'd expect him to be about 0.7. That's like the baseline I put on for a player I don't know a lot about in my projection model, like, for example. If I think they're slightly bad, I'll go slightly under 0.7. If I think they're slightly better, even though we haven't seen a lot of them, I'll go slightly over 0.7. 0.8 is where you're looking at a very good efficiency season. That player has been playing well in his touches, just based on this one efficiency stat, which is a really good one from AOdds.com and Josh Ernstmeyer. And again, Juju Smith-Schuster, one of the things we loved about him is he was insanely efficient. He was top-tier efficiency, as well as opportunity, as well as draft capital, as well as college production. Like, he never put a foot wrong. And that's something else I'd say there. This is the first thing Juju Smith-Schuster has ever done on a football field that fantasy football hasn't loved. So the drop in value and the over-woe is me about I drafted Juju Smith-Schuster. Like, he did one thing 1 year was not absolutely amazing. And in fact, looking at his numbers, why I say I don't think he's playing up to the player he is, that's based on his personal curve. Based on an average player, Jesus Schuster was great. He was definitely better than an average player with his opportunity and with what he did. He just wasn't a megastar with it. And I think I'm willing to give him one pass of just being, okay, that's fine, especially if we want to bake into some of the situation, but let's get to that later. So his efficiency was down for him, but it was even above average for an average wide receiver in the NFL getting significant volume. So I'm not overly worried about, like, his talent disappeared or anything like that, anything crazy like that. But there were some things I wanted to note here. One, just looking, one of the reasons I like to use not just the database that AR's put out, but they've got a graph section. If you go to players and then receiver efficiency, you can make a bunch of graphs for their career, for individual years, and plot like their yards after catch based on their touches or their efficiency based on their depth of target. And the really good visualizations of how a player performed. One of my first stops to try and break down whether a player was playing badly, what happened with his season, whether it's positive or negative. So one thing I was looking at with Juju Smith-Schuster was this yards after catch number. There's been a lot posted about it by much smarter people than me trying to break down the NFL. One of the things that seems to be proving true from the higher brain folks looking at analytics is that yards after the catch, for example, is much more about placement and depth of target. Like low depth of targets and with good placement produces yards after the catch. Now, there is exceptions to this rule. Further down the field, it's hard to get yards after the catch, in other words. And you've got exceptions in both directions. You've got DeSean Jackson, who's always going to have mega numbers yards after the catch, as well as Ted Ginn and the other tights. And then you've got Mike Evans, pretty much on an island by himself to get that level of volume and that poor yards after catch. But this isn't a Mike Evans podcast yet. So, Juju Smith-Schuster's most of his targets for the first 3 years come in a range where you should expect decent completion percentage, reception percentage, and decent yards after the catch. And that's actually what produced for his first two seasons. But just looking at the table under the graph here from yards.com, it just struck to me that he got 713 air yards and only 228 yards after the catch. Now, it just looks low, but I really can't assess, you know, I'm not... Numbers don't roll off my tongue, right? I have to go investigate that in context. So what I went and did is found out what percentage of Juju Smith-Schuster's receiving yards were actually yards after the catch. And in 2019, again, percentages are just even easy for a layman like me. Let me see if I can get the order right here. In 2019, about 41.5% of his yards came after the catch. His receiving yards came after the catch. So that was interesting, but I needed to put that in more context. So what I did is I looked back at his past 2 years. In his rookie season, 48%, or pretty much 49% of his receiving yards were actually yards after the catch. And in 2018, last year, his top 12 season, 46.9%, so again, pretty much 47%, of his receiving yards came after the catch. So that's like a 5 to 6-7% drop in terms of his receiving yards no longer coming after the catch. So there was a significant jump in yards after the catch, and considering what those higher brains have been talking about with placement and ADOT, that gave me somewhere to get into what could have been causing that. So I was looking at his ADOT, and this first year, it's the lowest ADOT he had in his career so far, it's 8.4. But the following 2 years, they've both been 10.3 and 10.2 in order from 2017, 18, and 19. So with the loss of Antonio Brown, I definitely think his targets got pushed further down the field, like lots of people predicted. Now, looking at his broad view yards after the catch and completion percentage, based on what the high brains were talking about, what produces yards after the catch and completion percentage, further down the field, Juju Smith-Schuster, I think, is showing a lack of efficiency and a lack of ability, just based on, you know, 2 years, which still isn't enough. We won't know who he is until his career is finished, but we have a significant enough sample right now, I think, to say that some of those fears at pushing him further down the field was worse for him. And now, a lot of people that viewed him on tapes suggested that. I couldn't really see it in the numbers that I looked at, but I just knew he was good, and for the first few years, that worked out well. But I definitely think some of those concerns were borne through in 2019, this last season. But again, bake into the situation to adjust for that a bit. I definitely think Juju Smith-Schuster has more to do down the field than we've currently seen. But it is interesting to see that borne through with some of the completions percentage compared to average numbers. Now, again, his ADOT, the average depth of his targets beyond the line of scrimmage, was about the same as it was last year, even with the loss of Antonio Brown. So it's not like he was pushed ultimately down the field. And again, the reason I'm pointing that out is because Juju probably should have done better with the player that we know he is. And that's where I'm taking that point from. His ADOT wasn't so far down the field that he was playing in such a different role that he shouldn't be able to do more of what he's typically capable of. But we know that things happen in regression. You can't hit 10 out of 10 every time. And like I said, this is the first time Juju Smith-Schuster hasn't been batting 9 or 10 out of 10. So let's be harsh on him in context, shall we? Just to go a little further into the context, like this drop of 5 to 6 to 7% of his receiving yards coming no longer after the catch, like a 7% drop in his receiving yards being before the catch, essentially, what he was delivered rather than what he produced after he caught it. I wanted to know, in context, is that typical for most wide receivers? Like 48.9%. In his rookie season, the 49% of his receiving yards came after the catch. Is he overly dependent on yards after the catch, and that's what happened last year? The drop in it seriously hurt him, because normally he's producing more yards after the catch. And there's a lot of way of looking at that, and I was just using the Air Yard database, and an interesting quirk of the Air Yard database and why I normally merit to my own NFL database is the positions. Like wide receiver, running back, tight end, they seem to get defunct really quickly. Like by the time you get to 2019, if you go download the AR database right now, like almost everyone is listed as unknown. Like Arian Foster, Rob Gronkowski, these guys are listed as unknown. Pretty much if they retire or aren't in the NFL anymore, they lose their position designation. I really wish they'd fix that, but they're putting out so much great content, I'm not going to complain ever. So that means that doing an average the way I did became tricky, but I think I did figure out a formula to get a pretty good perspective on what most wide receivers with their type of volume, with Juju Smith-Schuster type of volume, should do. So not to bore you with it, but that's essentially what I looked at. I broke down the average yards after the catch for wide receivers with Juju Smith-Schuster's type of volume and production every year. All right, let's not cross your eyes by trying to read you a list of numbers on a podcast. This isn't a video, and you're not looking at the numbers, and I know that can be difficult, but essentially what I found is that the average yards after the catch for most wide receivers with Juju Smith-Schuster's volume, with his type of role, is a base about what he's been doing. In fact, he's a little under-dependent on it, so he's not getting as many yards after the catch as the average player with his type of volume. Now, you could think Mike Evans, but to put this in perspective, I'm talking about 1 or 2% less than average. Mike Evans gets 20 to 30% less than average wide receivers with his kind of volume in yards after the catch. Like, it's phenomenally low. And again, not a Mike Evans podcast. He produced really well this year. Again, for a second time, yeah, you go, Mike Evans. But again, different players play different ways. And taking in a little bit of variance here because of the positions, I think Juju Smith-Schuster's yards after catch is typically about normal for a player with his type of volume. That's essentially what I'm telling you. But in 2019, it was significantly lower, like his yards after catch compared to his receiving yards, to be fair. You should expect it to be slightly lower, less than average, since his dropped compared to his own average. And in fact, it did. It was about 10%, just under 10% less than wide receivers with his type of volume in yards after the catch. Now, going back to what those high brains were thinking, there are two things that essentially explain yards after the catch, apart from Mike Evans, who's just weird. You've got placement and ADOT. And whereas ADOT was almost identical to last year, and he's still getting a lower percentage of his receiving yards after the catch, and a lower percentage compared to average after the catch, what's left is placement. And that brings us back to something that I normally don't do, which is talk about the situation and the quarterback. Ben Roethlisberger was down, bless him. Mason Rudolph was in. Yeah, kind of bless him. Bless his tiny little cotton socks. And he was nowhere near, obviously, the quarterback Big Ben is. And I don't think he was able to produce average quarterback numbers, which every wide receiver needs average, or they're already struggling. Very few wide receivers can elevate by themselves. Is Juju Smith-Schuster one of them? I think so. But based on his one opportunity when the rest of the team was definitely below average, he didn't elevate himself, let alone the rest of the team. And that is concerning. I think that's where the value concerns and drop on him comes from. But reading into the situation further, considering it to be more about ball placement, considering it to be more about he lost games and the team was struggling, that for me pushes it the responsibility of further away from what's Juju Smith-Schuster's ceiling, and more on to this team was in serious disarray for a lot of different reasons. So I dug into his raw numbers instead of just looking at air yards and ADOT and all that stuff a little bit more. And what I did is when I was RotoViz and looked at their expected points model. If you don't know what an expected points model is, me neither. I actually don't know what goes into their expected points model because they're all a little different. I do run an expected points model for the red zone, though, so I know the logic behind it. And essentially what you do is you weight every opportunity for a player based on how valuable it is. So some targets are easier to catch. Some targets are harder to catch. Some targets easier to get yards after the catch or bigger receiving numbers, and some are harder. And so you weight all of them based on an average of how difficult they are, and then you judge a player by how much opportunity was he getting, how valuable was it, how many points should you expect them to get based on their opportunity, based on those weightings. Essentially, expected points is a volume metric as well, but it's weighting it based on where they're getting the ball on the field. So it makes it a little more of an intricate look. And then if you look at fantasy points over expected or under expected, you get to see a much clearer view of whether they were efficient, whether they were doing more with their touches than can be expected based on the average. Now, I didn't look, I'm not going to talk about whether he was over or under. I've already said his fantasy points over expected was about average. He didn't do badly on it. Again, he just wasn't exceeding his opportunities is essentially the lesson from 2019, which you do hope a player with, that we had such a valuation on in the offseason can elevate. But I am given that slight asterisk on the team situation in general, and I'm going to dig into that in a little bit in a second. But what I wanted to look at was at his opportunity. Like, he got 105 expected points. But again, a number by itself provides no context. So what I wanted to do is note, based on his target share, was that a lot or a little? Was he getting a lot of valuable opportunity based on how the percentage of the team's targets he was getting, or was he getting a little bit? So I did his whole, well, I did everyone, but just looking at his 3 years, in his first year he got 104 expected points, so about the same. But based on his target share, he was only about 32 expected points away from average. So slightly lower. But again, he was a rookie, and he only had 12% target share. In 2019, he had 14% target share on only 12 games, but about the same number of expected points. So already, it kind of tells a story just saying that. But I actually did work out what it was below average, and it was 55 points below average. So about 20 expected points below average, even based on his target share. So he was getting less valuable opportunity, even with more targets than his a larger target share than his opportunity. Then it already tells you something about his situation, and I'm going to get to the red zone in a minute, which really shows it off to spectacular effect, in my opinion. And last year, by the way, he was 25 points over expected, or he got 25 more expected points than you would expect based on target share, and that's just where he was killing it and the type of things that we hoped, and I still think he's kind of capable of. So the last thing I want to look at here, I'll talk to you about, because I know this is probably a lot longer and a lot of numbers, but I looked at my expected points model. But my expected points model is taken directly from, by the way, in case I haven't mentioned this enough, it's actually TJ Hernandez's expected points model that he uses in the red zone. I've modified it for myself. I like to think I've made it my own, but it was entirely taught to me by him. I'm not saying this is something I came up with. He even literally, he's got a video out there which shows you how to go get the data and update it. I forget where that is. Some roster coach or something, or it used to be. It's really great, but I put out a history of it just in case you want to see the results. So it's weighting opportunity based on where players were getting targets, rush attempts, or pass attempts inside the red zone. So between the 20 and the 16, the 16 and the 10, and the 10 and the 5. So, like, it's easier to get a rushing touchdown inside the 5 than inside the 20, so both have a different expectation, right? In terms of fantasy points. Same thing with receivers with targets. Some are easier than others to score touchdowns on. All right. But it wasn't even the expected points model that really caught my eye when I went to look at it. In 2017, Juju Smith-Schuster, as a rookie with only 12% target share, he got 15 targets inside the red zone. And where did he get them? He got the majority of them between the 20 and the 16-yard line, so not even the most valuable targets, but he actually still scored, 30 red zone points, and it was actually overly efficient. He's caught more touchdowns than you'd expect with that kind of touches. In 2018, his mega season, he still got the majority of touches inside the 20 to 16-yard line, interestingly enough, but he also got 8 inside the 5-yard line, again, where he was heavily targeted in the red zone last year. So he got 15 targets inside the 20-yard line as a rookie, 28 inside the red zone as top 12 player in 2018. Turned to 2019, he got 7. Yeah, I slowed down just so you that could have that effect. He got 7 targets. But, you know, maybe that was the same percentage of touches, and it was just the team was getting inside the red zone a lot less. And so what I did is I dug back through the history I've got of this, and I found that in 2018, the Steelers went to the red zone or had 227 touches, passes, rushes, and targets inside the red zone. In 2019, the team had 151. So definitely 100 less targets or 100 less touches in the red zone is a significant drop, which, you know, they went 8-8 this season. I still really don't know how they managed it with these type of numbers. But they had a fairly poor season, so you'd expect them to be in the red zone a lot less. But 7? Seven was who was getting the targets. And in fact, if you look at 2019, no one really dominated in terms of targets inside the red zone. The highest red zone touch in target share for the team was 9, and that was Vance McDonald. You've also got Deontay Johnson getting 7 with a similar distribution to Juju Smith-Schuster, interestingly enough. He actually scored a touchdown on it, though. Juju Smith-Schuster got no touchdowns. You can't really, and based on my red zone points model, you can't expect a touchdown with their level of targets. Deontay Johnson's a little overexpected, and Juju Smith-Schuster's a little underexpected because one caught a touchdown and one didn't. They really weren't getting enough volume that you should even expect them to catch any more than 0-1 touchdowns. So Juju Smith-Schuster wasn't even ineffective or inefficient in the red zone. He just got no volume there. And what I do see comparing the past seasons with Ben Roethlisberger compared to Mason Rudolph, and you know, there's a lot of variance in there, but overall no one was getting a high proportion, whereas of the last few years, there were not only more touches, but there were players getting significant, he was focusing specific players. And what I also noticed compared to different years is that Mason Rudolph, or whoever was throwing them, whether it was Delvin Hodges or Mason Rudolph, in any situation, and the running backs and tight ends were getting a higher proportion of red zone targets. And that goes back to ADOT and placement. Everything I look at for this team suggests they not only spread the ball out, they spread the ball out a lot closer to the line of scrimmage. That's what explains red zone, Jalen Samuels actually being the target leader inside the red zone outside of Vance McDonald with 8. And you've also got James Washington, Deontay Johnson, all these guys getting 2 to 7 targets, and James Conner getting 5. The red zone targets were getting pushed more towards tight ends and running backs closer to the line of scrimmage, even within the 20-yard line compared to the 5-yard line. So essentially, one of the places that Juju Smith-Schuster's points dried up, despite being above average in efficiency and decent with his targets, more we would expect more from the type of player he is. He did badly for him, but compared to most plays, he did fine. But you can't score points without the ball, and he literally wasn't being thrown the ball, despite what expected points were showing us, that he had 105, which is similar to what he did in his rookie season. Like, inside the red zone, they were gone. He had no targets, basically, or no targets that we could expect him to score touchdowns on, and touchdowns are where the majority, oftentimes, fantasy points come from. So the red zone breakdown of the Steelers as a team, and remember, Deontay Johnson did really well this season. Like, that's a prospect we were iffy on, but kind of liked coming in. You know, lots of people like because we went to the Steelers and they have a weird process. But he did produce well in college, and him showing this well is really positive for him. I'm not taking just as a flyby here. Let's point out Deontay Johnson did really well, certainly better than DeAndre Moncrief. So he's someone that we should definitely be interested in dynasty. But I still think Juju Smith-Schuster seems to be the one. I do think he has a higher upside. And overall, going back to just what I think of receiving opportunity, Deontay Johnson being good is good for Juju Smith-Schuster. If Deontay Johnson can keep improving, that's even better for Juju Smith-Schuster. So it doesn't bring me down on Juju. If anything, it gives me more hope the situation can improve, and that can help Juju Smith-Schuster. So what it all comes down to, and that's probably where most people are going to take it, let's face it, this offseason, is will the team improve? Improve is a strong word, or maybe it's an overly harsh word. Like Mason Rudolph, for all the fun we could have at him, and I'm sure we could, he said some not so nice things, or some people said some not nice things to him. I honestly have no idea. But as a player, I think he was below average. Could he improve? Sure. Could Ben Roethlisberger come back? Yes, in which case, yeah, that would be a vast improvement because that quarterback is above average, which is always positive. But I think even another year in the system, having played more with Mason Rudolph, with Deontay Johnson coming on, even before we really dig into the Steelers in 2020, there's enough reason to expect that the team shouldn't have as dire problems getting into the red zone as it did this year. I do think that if it remains Mason Rudolph, we have concerns because his tendency in his small tenure as quarterback has been to throw inefficient, poor passes close to the line of scrimmage to other players, which tends to be a sign of a player not being able to steal a film term here, make the big throws. Now, Hopefully someone will come on and say, that's not happening on tape, Pete. Mason Rudolph can make big throws. And maybe he can. But he's spreading them to Jalen Samuels overly compared to the team average and compared to most teams. And no one's getting focused highly enough, despite the fact we know at least Juju Smith-Schuster and apparently Deontay Johnson are significantly distancing themselves in target share, that we know these guys are better than the majority of his options, but he's not finding them in the red zone. And a lack of red zone opportunities because the team was struggling anyway, if we need more answers to that, compared to last year or most NFL teams. So I just realized I've gone past the 30-minute mark. Normally I try to get under, especially when it's just me. So I'm going to leave it there. There's more you can say. I'm interested to see what other people find, but that's what stood out to me when I started breaking down Juju Smith-Schuster's role. Now, I do think there's some of the ceiling where the situation is uncertain, but that can spike both ways. Uncertainty means it can spike up, it can spike down. So there is still upside there. I am more concerned with him. I think it's less likely he's a top 12 receiver when this offseason, like, I really thought he was, you know, top 5 fairly easily based on what he had done before. But I am trying to remember more than anything else, this is the first time he was below his personal average of elite. And that's not bad. That's really not terrible. Remember, like I said about rookies, we're about to spend 3 months discussing players who might be good that we know almost nothing about. So the one thing I want to keep in mind is, the one thing I do know about Juju Smith-Schuster, he is definitely good at the NFL level. He's definitely been elite at the NFL level. And he's actually only produced one season less than being elite at any level. I'm not panicking on Juju Smith-Schuster. And if there's a buying window, yeah, I'm open to it. But let me know. Contact us at Dynasty Crossroads on Twitter. Own me there too. There's not enough owning me on the Crossroads, and being owned on every other pod I come here, no one owns me. So please, let me know why I'm wrong, how you feel. Or if I didn't answer a question or interested in another aspect of Juju Smith-Schuster's 2019 and I didn't get to it, let me know and I'll try and address that one too. But thanks, guys. I will talk to you again next week and see you next time at the Crossroads. Bye.
Yeah. Chicken or crow, chicken or crow, crossing the road, go. Clicking a poll, Twitter is gold, player unfold, so. Jake on the table going Nate on the plays, no. Pete enumerates the plays, they're analytical. Picking my nose, don't really know if I like that. Picking their brains, got their lanes, but I like that. Picking these guys, all of these times, all of these nice stats. Picking apart, the film is an art, always a fight. Back and forth, there is no order, they disorder more and more. Because the players ain't no older, they some hoarders or some mortars. Dropping bombs without no borders, Jake got that I like Mordor. Peak grinding numbers like molars, I don't know anymore. I am at a crossroads. Chicken or crow, crossing the road. Go, clicking a poll, Twitter is gold, player unfold, so Jake on the table and Nate on the plays, though. Pete enumerates the plays, they're analytical. Chicken or crow, crossing the road, go. Clicking a poll, Twitter is gold, player unfold, so Jake on the table and Nate on the plays, though. Pete enumerates the plays, they're analytical.